Welcome to the Original Gangsters Podcast, a very, very special edition. This week, I am humbled and honored and privileged to bring on a dynamic duo of when we're talking about reporting and then the being the subject of a fascinating report last month in the New York Sun. Daniel Rosen published a in-depth piece on a lost slice of American LCN history, a real what could have been, but it also was a forebearer of something that foreshadowed law enforcement's surveillance techniques for decades to come. And the gist of it, and we'll get into it, is that there had been a Mafia Commission meeting set for Montauk, Long Island, at a mobbed up resort, a hotel that I think is still there. And there was supposed to be a meeting around Labor Day 1979 of all the five families, as well as Santo Traficante from the Florida Mafia Don out of Tampa. And this was really a lost piece of history until Daniel dug it up and then got with a number of the members of law enforcement that were on the scene at the time. And the principal member of the law enforcement group that consisted of federal and local agencies, but FBI agent Dennis Buckley, who was joining us as well, was at the center of all of this. It was a could have been Appalachian times a million, or the Boston or ceremony in 89 times a million. But at the last second, the commission meeting was canceled. But the whole place was wired for sound. Dozens of FBI agents crawling around that place in September of 79, anticipating a commission meeting that never happened. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us. Dennis, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Sir, thank you very much. Thank you for having us.
And that was a long preamble. People tell me I got to shut up. Shut up a little bit more.
It was a great preamble. Don't.
I'm going to hand it over. So, Daniel, first tell us how you came about reporting on this piece of lost history that's just so compelling and now has so much context that we can glean from it 50 years later. And Dennis, talk about when Daniel's done setting that stage. Talk about being at ground zero on this whole thing. So Daniel kind of started off and then hand it over to Dennis.
No, thank you so much. Thank you for having me. I'm a big fan of the podcast and touched to be on here. So thank you guys. I had been, as like a side project, I've been interviewing a good number of Dennis's former colleagues who worked out of the Brooklyn Queens MRA. And there was this somewhat overlooked field office that operated out of Queens and had covered the Eastern District. And a lot of the agents who worked there, guys like Steve Carbone, Ed Guevara, Dennis Buckley, Edwin J. Sharp, who figures prominently in the story, George Hanna, and the assortment of others. These were guys who were very well regarded within the Bureau, both former and current, as being these somewhat outsized personalities, but more so guys who had worked some of the biggest cases in New York City history.
Iconic
cases. Yes, sir. So you look at LaFonza, you look at Boston College, you look at, the commission trial, you look at Pizza Connection. And so through them, I had heard somewhat tangentially of Gurney's. They all kind of said it. They spoke of it, it was a lost opportunity or certainly something that it gave them a laugh now, but it was, at least in my mind, a very fascinating story that had yet to be fully told. And what appealed to me about the story, and I'll set it up for Dennis, but when it happened in 1979, the Bureau was still somewhat improving the way it had investigated organized crime. It was, Edwin J. Sharp and Neil Welch, who was the head of the New York office at the time.
Yep.
They were very big on approaching organized crime investigations by, you know, recorded evidence, you know, basically trying to establish the existence of a conspiracy using RICO to its fullest extent. And so what was also interesting is you had this, you know, this aforementioned generation of young agents who were like Dennis and everyone city-wise, you know, certainly a very young, eager generation of agents. And so, you know, I'll hand it over to Dennis just to set the stage of what the Bureau was like at the time, especially with organized crime. But, you know, the way the Gurney's tip had come through, it seemed like this could have been a moment of seismic importance for the Bureau, especially.
Tell everyone, before you hand it over, Dennis, tell everyone what Gurney's Inn is. Yes. It's like a resort on Long Island that is iconic in its own right at this point.
Exactly. It's so Gurney's was started. It was founded in the 1920s by this Christian Scientist couple that didn't like drinking and certainly restricted who can walk into the hotel. It was one of the few places that could serve food. Nick Monty, who was this larger than life personality who owned Monty's Venetian. You know, he wasn't in the mob, but he certainly had a rabbi, as they say.
He was a mafia adjacent, as we like to
say. Mafia adjacent, precisely. And he was in Carroll Gardens. So, I mean, it's sort of unavoidable. But he, you know, long story short, he went there for a dinner or lunch. He wanted to drink. The woman at the time, Maud Gurney, said, "We don't serve alcohol." And he gave her his card and said, "You know, love for you to, you know, if you ever think about selling, let me know. I'd definitely like to bring booze into this place." And, you know, just sort of summarizing there. But lo and behold, he was sold the place in the 1950s and then went about like transforming it and turning it into kind of this Montauk institution. And also, you know, I would say probably one of the most consequential figures in the history of Montauk and the East End in terms of just turning it into an actual resort and seeing the full potential.
The area became kind of trendy and swanky before it had been a sleepy fishing town.
I mean, yeah, lately, you know, it's now a very, very expensive, trendy place. But, you know, Nick, being a very savvy Brooklyn restaurateur and just knowing the right people and having these, and I'd say, and this comes by way of his nephew who helped run it with him, like having a very keen sense of customer service. You know, he had basically turned it into this great resort that was routine. You know, celebrities went there. Nixon went there. Dwight, it was a huge hit. So to set the stage for Dennis, you know, it made sense that with the aforementioned ties to Brooklyn, to Carroll Gardens and what have you, that this would be the site of a place for some type of mob meetup.
So enter Dennis Buckley, superstar mob buster from the BQ, the Brooklyn Queens division of the FBI. It's August of 1979, and you meet with one of your CIs and get an epic tip. Take it over, my man.
Okay. Well, it's just starting off. I was a young agent at the time, going on 28, 29, and I had a particular CI, or what we would call TE in those days. I had a senior agent, knew him, and a fast meeting at a particular restaurant out on Long Island was set up between him and myself. And we left it that if he could help the FBI in providing information on organized crime or illegal activities or whatever that we would be interested in. And of course, we had an agreement that a fiscal monetary value would be placed on the information that he would provide us whenever he could. And so that's how it really began. It started out on a small little restaurant out on Long Island that he had some type of ownership in. And actually, it closed maybe a month after I had met him. But he then reached out to me through the system we set up. And then we became associates, him being on the inside of the mob and myself trying to figure out what was the best way that the FBI could use the information that he would provide us and how we could penetrate the mob. And just going back a little prior to that, how we worked cases when I first started was that we would use individuals or cooperating witnesses, and we would target just one individual. We would target like yourself or me and try to get a case on that individual. We didn't explore the idea, even though it was out there about the RICO and, hey, we could broaden the horizons by let's try to get more than one person involved in a criminal activity. And with that, he had provided information all along about various aspects of who was doing what was going on. Right during that time frame, there was a mob war somewhat going on where Carmine Galante, who was one of the top bosses, was murdered in a pizzeria in Queens. In fact, I was one of the agents there at the scene when they did the autopsy of Carmine Galante and his two bodyguards that were killed in the pizzeria. And the information from my particular source was that the mob war was getting blown up out of control, but Galante had stepped over the line regarding the drugs. And obviously, to get a guy like Galante killed, they had to be higher ups to give the approval. And following that, he had gotten wind of the possibility of a meeting of higher ups, organized crime leaders, to discuss the future and what else was going to take place after Galante's demise.
And anybody that saw the movie Donnie Brasco or read the book Donnie Brasco knows that Santo Trafficante, although not one of the, not a boss of one of the five families, but a formidable mafia powerhouse in his own right down south in Florida, he was doing business with the Bananos. And from people that I spoke to after reading this article, to get a little bit more color regarding why this meeting took place, told me that the meeting was to inform Trafficante of, because this was 2 months after Trafficante, or 2 months after Galante is assassinated, Trafficante is coming east, going to New Jersey and New York, and they're going to meet with him and explain to him what happened and how they go forward with their business. Let's also, we'll never know who the CI was, but based on what we learned from some of the documents and intelligence that was put in to get warrants and authorization, it's public knowledge, and it was shared in Dan's story, that this was a made member of the Genovese crime family, but somebody that was also very close to leadership in the Gambino crime family. So this was a West Side guy who had personal relationships with both bosses in the Genovese and Paul Castellano himself, who was the boss of the Gambinos.
Correct. Yes. Yes. And as you said, it was the relationship with Paul Castellano and the particular CI was a personal one. It wasn't one of a business
right
aspect of a family, but the CI was smart enough and knew enough that Castellano, like most of them, but he was one of the ones that if you paid a tribute to him, even though you didn't work for him, then he would become your friend. Obviously, he's getting something, whether it's money or whatever, from you. And so then he would become your friend. And they were very close in age, too. So that brought a camaraderie between the CI and Castellano.
And Nick Monti, who owns the Gurney's Inn and owns a very popular Italian restaurant right in, you know, talk about, we said ground zero for Dennis was at ground zero in Brooklyn, Carroll Gardens, the Colombo crime family, the Persicos. That was a big hangout. Absolutely. So Nick Monti had ties to all these other, you know, all these other different crime lords in different families.
Correct. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, just to add to that, you know, I think it was, you know, they had operated, I believe, in Colombo territory or in the Gallo brothers territory. And, you know, his, you know, Monti's relatives, they had said that, you know, they, there would be the occasional scrap, you know, the Gallo brothers would certainly go a little, get a little haywire sometimes, but it really was, you know, I never saw in any ways like puritanical in the sense of like, oh my, I can't believe this restaurant, you know, this restaurant had ties to the mob. They didn't. It's just, this is the nature of the beast of New York City. Like you can have a restaurant that's going to be in mob territory. Unfortunately, the cost of doing business is, you know, having to basically pay protection. But the beauty, you know, the effect of both the eventual effect of both RICO and FBI and Department of Justice in their investigations in the ensuing years is that that was no longer the case. Like people could actually continue to operate businesses without having kind of a restraint of trade, as Lou Shalera would call. But I actually want to throw this question to Dennis, because this is a great tidbit that I unfortunately didn't make into the story. But could you just tell me the when you were asked to meet with Fonzie?
Yes. Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah. Correct. At the time on the organized crime section that we were in, it was BQ3 was the squad, and we were called the intelligence squad. And so we would be tasked to try to get whatever information we could of how many members, where they lived, blah, blah, blah. So after the killing of Galanti, we each were assigned to go out and interview one of the bosses. And in fact, I actually had two of them, but my first one was interviewing Fonzie Thierry, Frank Thierry, and he was the head of the Genovese family at the time. So, you know, as a young agent, I ring the doorbell. It's opened up by the housekeeper, and she said, "Yes, Mr. Thierry, we'll speak to you." So I walk in, and the room is something, you know, very dark, sinister. And in the back of my mind, I think I'm hearing the Godfather music, you know, playing. And so I go in, and he's very gracious. He was sitting down, and never forget this. He stands up, and as he stands up, he moved his right hand, almost like where, you know, your ring finger is, and he caught himself. And it was almost like, you know, automatic that anybody would come in, would kiss his ring. And so I sat down a little shaken up by that move, to tell you the truth, because it kind of said, geez, this guy, what does he expect here? And so I told him, I said, we can't tolerate the killings. The murders have to stop. And the government is going to use its force to put all this to an end. And his comment was unbelievable. He looked at me straight in the eye and he said, "Agent Buckley, when your person has cancer in the body, sometimes you have to cut the part out. It could be a leg, it could be an arm, it could be whatever. And then once the part is removed, the body will continue and there should be no more cancer."
No more amputations are needed.
And that's how he left it. And on my way out, he said, "Leave a card." So I looked over at the table and I put my business card on the table. There must have been 30 other cards still there of various law enforcement people that had spoken to him throughout the years. And
he was straight out of Central Casting. If Benny might throw a picture up here for people to take a look at him. I mean, he looked like if you were going to cast a leading man to be a mob boss in a movie, Frank Fonzie Thierry was met. You know, they broke the mold when they made him.
They did. know, so we each had a boss. And then, in fact, the other one I interviewed, didn't last as much as Thierry's, was Tony Ducks Carollo.
Yeah, out of Lucchese.
Yeah. And but that was that's where we were instructed to, you know, go out and try to say, hey, this has got to calm down. We want no more killings, and we're going to start coming after you if this continues. And that was his way of saying, it'll be over. Don't worry about it, agent. We'll be okay.
And things quieted down there for a couple of years until they sparked back up in the spring of 81 with the three Capos hits. But I digress. Let's just real quick go back to, you get a tip in August that there might be something on the horizon. And let's tell people that there was a Genovese capo named Joe Schiappone, went by Uncle Joe or Joe by the Bay or Joe Ship. He had possibly a silent ownership interest in Gurney's. And he was somebody that would often act as a kind of a go-between for people that wanted to meet at Gurney's and in the city. Can you expand a little bit about who he was?
Sure. I in terms of meeting out there, Joe Shep basically ran all of Brooklyn Sanitation.
Yeah.
And, you know, the FBI did investigate that, I guess, in the late 70s or early 70s, excuse me, and all five boroughs, just mob control of sanitation. But, you know, Joe Shep, you know, he was a pretty big guy. This came by way of Frank DiMatteo, who's, you know, he's a published author. He's certainly written about his background and his childhood growing up and his involvement in the Gallo brothers, in the Gallo boys, excuse me. But Joe Shep was basically his uncle, I believe, and through Nick Monte had invested a good amount of money. Now, I don't know if that amount of money was to purchase it or in subsequent years to help refurbish it, because, you know, the Nick had spent millions just adding to the property. In fact, in 79, when this operation took place, or the attempt took place, they had just opened up like a $4 million health spa that would unfortunately prove to be Monty's financial undoing in the property itself. They sold it for a ton of money, so they made out okay. But so Joe Shep, you know, according to Frank, they would go out there, they would have dinners there, they would have weekends there. In Frank's book, unfortunately, we didn't get it in time for the article too, but it was a great photo. I had called Frank just really out of happenstance, because I reached out to all these guys, all these like Newtonese mobsters who now have podcasts, but mm-hmm. to see if they had any, like what they knew about, you know, Gurney's. And I just reached out to Frank, and Frank was like, and Frank basically said, oh yeah, my uncle Joe Shep, he was a silent investor. I'm like, come on, you can't be, that can't be, that's too good to be true. And lo and behold, I checked out his book, one of his books, and in the back of the book is a picture of him, Joe Shep, and some family members that was taken on New Year's Eve, 1979, 1980. At Gurney's, I'm in black tie, months after this attempt. And so it really was like one of those, like, it was an incredible moment for, at least for me, because it showed that this was in many ways a viable attempt. And I will say that in subsequent years, Joe Shep would meet with John Gotti out at Gurney's multiple times. You know, John Gotti would keep a place there.
And they did. There was a sit down that came out in a court filing that mm-hmm. he helped broker a sit down between Gotti and some of the Lucchese's in 1990.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And then just tie up. Last thing I'll say, and I want to turn over to Dennis, and he'll take us through the actual event. Joe Shep's current link to the modern day Genovese crime families through Ali Shades, who's as old school as old school can be. I think he's in his late 80s, and I heard he's doesn't get around as well as he used to, but that the top brass, Barney and Ernie and those guys, Danny Pagano, Patsy Perello, that they take counsel from Ali Shades. And Ali Shades inherited all of his sanitation rackets from Joe Shep. So Dennis, take us. So you get the tip, and you guys are working it for a couple of weeks, and then you think that there's a point in time in September where you think it's going to go down. Take us through it.
Okay. Well, after I had gotten this information, obviously I went back to my office, and then we had a couple of other top echelon TE informants, one in the Newark office, and actually we had another informant out on Long Island area. And those two came back saying, yes, it's a logical place. If they do get together, it would be Gurney's. And they all mentioned about Nick Monte. So with that information, I had an SAC by the name of Edwin Sharp, who was one of the first investigators as a special agent or as a supervisor in Miami, did a RICO case on two bookmakers. And so when he heard this information, he was in charge of the office at the time. He said, hey, we want to make this as best as we can. Let's not just target one person. Let's target everybody. So once the information came in that it was good probability and that Gurney's would be a great location for the meeting, we then put into action, well, what are we going to do? And with that, it was like a football game. We had various agents from other divisions. As Dan knows, we had female agents. There weren't many of them at the time, but whatever we did have, we used them and we put them out to Montauk. We had surveillance vehicles. We used surveillance planes. Dan interviewed many of these people. He knew stuff that I didn't know, to tell you the truth, because I was just involved with the TE. And my job, obviously, was to be ready when he wanted contact made and any update on any information. So actually, Dan probably knows more about who did what at the cover agents than I did.
It was all hands on deck. I mean, this was considered top priority from the highest levels of the FBI. And that's why you had this dream team of agents, guys that had come from all these iconic cases like the Pizza Connection and the Lufthansa heist and all that stuff. You had all these guys and Dennis all kind of coming together to try to bug a commission meeting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So with that, we all headed out Gurney's at various times. We had one agent undercover that booked a lot of rooms, saying he was a real estate investor. And so we had various rooms and various agents in various locations. And then we waited. And as I said, there's a lot of the aspects that I didn't personally get involved with, but I did get involved with contacting the informant, the TE, which I was in a room, in a hotel room with one of my supervisors at the time, Lou Shalero. And when the call came in, the TE was annoyed, saying it took him an hour to get into Gurney's because the phones were tied up. And that's probably true. That was us on the phone, idiots. I can say that, me or whatever. And but anyway, he had no further information, just that he just heard, hey, from what he learned, it was going to happen. It was still on. The meet was still on. And then it came a point in time that I felt I had to go see him. So it was early one morning. I drove from Gurney's early in the morning to where we would meet at a certain location, let's just say in Brooklyn. And face-to-face, anything new and this and that. And then back out to Gurney's and we waited. And as Dan knows, he did great reporting on it. We were all set. And it was like we were one football team. I think you said Lou Shalero said the other team. It was like the Super Bowl. And they didn't show up. For whatever reason, we thought possibly did we get made. But then we thought, well, you know, and Ed Sharp always thought that in the back of his mind. But no, we really weren't sure what caused them to not show up. Was it us or was it something that we had no idea why they didn't meet? But we were ready for them. That's for sure.
Let me ask you this, and I apologize if I put you on the spot here. but and this is just me literally kind of brainstorming in real time. Is there any way that your CI tipped them off?
You know, I don't, you know, I can really say 90% no, because he had nothing to gain. Why give me the information?
Right.
To begin with. And he was providing information on other activities that we paid him for. So, you know, he would be cutting his throat by doing that. And then at the same time, you know, he knew that I was using the information. He knew that we were out there. So if anything, he wanted this thing to take place.
If you have like over, you know, 36 agents in the proximity of the Gurney's Inn, the resort that was across the street, you guys brought in some special undercover unit from Vermont, who are the guys that are going to act like they're the real estate investors or what have you.
Oh, so Bob Shorrell. Yeah, he was actually, he's a Vermont native, but he was at BQ.
Oh, he was a from BQ. Okay.
Yeah, he looked like somebody out of a cigarette ad.
This thing was a week-long operation from September 12th through September 18th, I believe, of 1979. You guys were on high alert, embedded in Montauk. Can you talk about how, even though, unfortunately for you guys, you're not able to get these guys on tape meeting, but how a lot of the tactics that were used in, you know, logistically setting this up were pioneering for later on operations that did bear fruit, where the Bureau was able to get very incriminating, historically significant conversations recorded.
Dennis, you want me to jump in quick, or
just to leave it like this, the case against Chin Gigante, whatever, where we put the bugs down in the parking meters and so forth.
In the village,
you know, again, this was the baptismal, if I say, of, hey, you know, you want to get everybody on recording. You just don't want to attack. And I had, as a young agent, one of the first cases I had was against Frank Thierry's driver, Johnny. I'd have to think of it. I think it was Musso or whatever. And we got him because somebody wore a recording against him because he was a loan shark. So we got him on loan sharking activities. Well, this was the baptismal of, forget the loan sharking activities. We want to go after the entire group, the organization, and get as many of the higher ups as we can. And that's really, I think, the beginning of what Gurney's pushed the Bureau to do. Get away from the individual subject and go after subjects with an F.
I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, I believe Thierry was the first, when he eventually was convicted, I think in 81, I think he was convicted under the RICO Act, and that might have been the first leader of organized crime to be convicted under the RICO Act. There would be, you know, the dam would break after that, but I believe Thierry was nailed in 80 or 81, and then Jimmy Licavoli out of Cleveland was hit and convicted of it, but those were the first two organized crime figures to really be affected by RICO.
Right. Correct.
Daniel, can you talk a little bit about what you learned from talking to all the other members of law enforcement in addition to Dennis?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, just to talk about the methodology, you know, the methods used and the agents there, you know, they had, you know, you had Lisa Grobe and Ed Tickle. And Ed Tickle was this, you know, he was a legendary figure in the sense that he had, you know, he was one of the best black bag operatives the Bureau had at the time. You know, he had, you know, essentially going back to what you were, you know, what Dennis, you were talking about, pioneering recording methods. He was excellent at impressioning keys and breaking in and seamlessly installing recording devices in rooms. And then through that, securing substantial evidence. Unfortunately, a short while after the Gurney's, he would be arrested, fired, and I guess convicted for transporting stolen diamonds across state lines, and giving—I think he gave like two-way radios that were technically FBI property to Richard Petty's race team.
Well, everyone has bad days.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I'm sure you know, Dennis knew him. I mean, like, yeah, he was a character, right?
Yeah, he was caught breaking into the safe in the FBI credit union.
So, well, it happens. So go ahead, Daniel.
Oh no, no. That
he was a top flight black bad guy and was able to do some stuff in that operation that would lay the groundwork for future operations.
Because what they had then, you know, when Bob Schorgel checked in, there was it was the 1979 linear accelerator conference that was being hosted by the Brookhaven National Lab in Long Island, and it was notable in that, and you know, it, unbeknownst to the FBI, they had they had some Cold War intrigue at the time, but it was the first time that China had sent linear accelerators to an American conference. And so when Bob arrived, they only had about eight or so rooms available. And so that's why most agents, you know, they stay at the Panoramic View Hotel next door. They stayed in, you know, within Montauk Town. But, you know, in the evenings around 3 a.m. or so, you know, Tickle and Lisa Grobe, and Lisa Grobe was this, you know, one of the first generation of female agents after Hoover died, and they allowed recruitment of females to be special agents. She would basically be serving as lookout and, you know, and distract those who may walk in on Mr. Tickle impressioning keys. But he had basically fabricated enough keys to serve as a master. And, you know, they had installed Steve Carbone, who would later come to, you know, at the time he was working the Lufthansa investigation. And then he had eventually he would oversee the Henry Hill flipping with Ed Guevara and Ed McDonald. And Ed McDonald, I should add just very quickly, Ed McDonald, who was at the Department of Justice, he was there on hand because the way they could only secure a Title III, because everything was somewhat tentative, that it was they could get an emergency provision where instead of knowing immediately who was going to be present, where it was going to be, they had 48 hours to basically record and then kind of like as a after the fact submit all the evidence to secure that Title III to authorize it. So you know, it was a seldom used provision that they unfortunately didn't have to they didn't use it then, but you know, it just went to show just how prepared and how they basically had all their bases covered, ready for this thing to happen that, you know, in heartbreaking fashion didn't.
But Dennis, I'll say that, and Daniel, just in my cursory follow-up research, I believe, take it for what it's worth, you guys lived it and reported it and researched it well longer than I have. But I believe that this was solid information. Just based on someone I spoke to that was able to confirm that Traficante had flown into Newark around that time period. So we know that he was in that part of the country in that week. I got to believe that the information was good and somehow somebody got spooked, whether it came from Schiappone or Nick Monti, or somehow, and then it was canceled at the last minute. I don't believe that this was bad intel. Dennis?
Yeah, well, I never heard of that. I mean, you know, I had heard tidbits about Traficante coming up, but you just kind of confirmed that was the crux of why they were having this meeting, quite honestly, was regarding the drug trafficking. Till this day, you know, I always say, did we get made as the FBI out there? And what Daniel kind of said, that there were groups out there that didn't know that their FBI was out there. But, you know, in the back of my mind, I can't say why. I don't know if it was us, them, or whatever, why they didn't show I don't know, but we had all the bases covered. They say as in baseball. And I told Daniel, I felt like I was the last guy, bases loaded, up at the plate. I took a swing and struck out. But if you don't take the swing and you hit the ball, you never get anywhere.
Well, you know, again, I think that it's more than just the one swing and miss, if you will. It's the precedent that it's set. And I think it also shows just how in a decade, just go from the beginning of the decade of the 70s to the end of the decade of the 70s, think about how transformational that was. And I think represented this situation kind of represented that change in mindset, where it went from there really wasn't much of a priority from the federal government to go after organized crime, definitely not to go after the biggest fish at the biggest levels coordinating meetings together, to 1979, where even though it doesn't you don't hit pay dirt, you had the entire bureau from top to bottom all, you know, chomping at the bit to make this happen. So I think it's more important. There's more historical significance to this than just the fact that it was a failed operation.
Right. Right. No, I agree 100%. Absolutely.
And I would also say that it's not, you know, Trafficante at the time was working with the assassins, not the assassinated. He wasn't working with Galante's people and those Pizza Connection people. Trafficante was working with Sonny Black and the Brooklyn people that were the ones that came together to kill Galante. So he was on the right side of that little mob war.
Right, right, right.
As we wrap up here, I'll just say, you know, check out Daniel's story in the New York Sun. It's called How the FBI's Mad Dash to Wiretap the Mob at a Montauk Hotel Nearly 50 Years Ago Helped Modernize Today's Agency. It is a great, they don't, you know, Daniel, you know this, and I can just tell that we've known each other now for a short period of time, but I can tell we're kindred spirits just by the way you wrote that story, because kudos to your editor and your paper for allowing you to do that kind of deep dive. I would be saying this if he was in front of me or not. You could take this article, just this article, without the fact that take away the fact that they didn't actually bug it. This article itself could be made into a TV miniseries.
Absolutely.
That's the way the twists and turns of this, the kind of reporting that you get here, that isn't, unfortunately, you don't see that every day, especially in regards to organized crime in the 220.
Thank you. Well, no, thank you. That's a huge compliment.
You know, that is absolutely correct, because my granddaughter, who just was recently visiting me, she just turned 16, and she said, "Wow, they call me Fox." And I said, "Wow, Fox, maybe they'll become a movie out of this." So great. 16-year-old that read the story.
And great pictures too. He's got some great photos directly from some of the agents, and the photos really kind of capture that 1979 vibe, that Donnie Brasco vibe. It's great. Please, Dennis, can you just, as we wrap up here, can you give people the post addendum to what was your career? When did you end up retiring? And what other things were you able to do in, you know, the FBI going up against LCN?
Okay, well, just going back after this, as I said, we were on a BQ3 intelligence squad by the supervisor Lou Shalero, and I took place in a particular raid in a house in Brooklyn where we caught Jerry Langeller.
Oh yeah,
Snake Persico as yeah. living, and they weren't allowed, you know, to meet, and we got information that they'd be meeting in this house in Brooklyn, and we surrounded the house, and they came out the back door, and I became famous as the agent that was screaming his head off, "Stop, stop," because there were 20 of them, and it was only me and another agent. So everybody heard me screaming, but thank God no shots were fired. And then, of course, I testified against Langella in in probation court. After that, I did the Pizza Connection case. I had a particular case. It kind of evolved into the pizza case. I think I mentioned this to Daniel. It was a case called Brooknor, and it's known as it was a pseudonym for Brooklyn North Narcotics. And long story short, we took an undercover police officer who was buying drugs from a guy by the name of Salvatore Bartolotta, Sicilian drug trafficker, who happened to be the brother-in-law of Lorenzo Scaduto. I'm throwing these names out. I know.
Yeah. No, and people, believe me, this audience, they eat this stuff up.
Well, and Lorenzo Scaduto's brother was the head of the Sicilian mob in Sicily. Long story short, we used the police officer. He made buys. We then got information from a TE informant up in Buffalo that a shipment was coming in Port Newark. We raced out undercover at night, 20 of us, from 3 a.m. to 6 a.m. We found the drugs hidden in tiles that were held by like wooden cases. And in the wooden cases was heroin worth $80-90 million that we took out. We placed it with sugar in those days and sent it up to Buffalo. And then, long story short, we arrested six of them in Brooklyn. A guy by the name of Ragusa was the head of it. And then, actually, I was lucky enough to testify over in Italy twice because we tracked it to six drug traffickers in Sicily that all went on trial. And it makes you appreciate America because when I was on the stand, these guys are in cells in the back of the room screaming. And they weren't saying, look at that nice FBI agent up there. they were making gestures that they were going to chop my head off and this and that. And so anyway, that was one of the historical cases that I worked. From there, I got transferred to Washington. Long story short, I was on the drug trafficking squad unit in Washington. From there, I was transferred as the agent in charge of Allentown, Pennsylvania. Oh. I was up there for 7 years, and then I did such a great job, they brought me back to New York as a reward to be the assistant agent in charge of drugs and organized crime under Lou Shalero, who Dan knows.
Well, hopefully we'll be lucky enough to get Dennis back here to talk about some more of his these movie scripts that he's lived. Every case, I say this to these agents. I was like, every case is a movie script. Every case is a TV series. And it's true, man. And Daniel, please tell all our audience where they can consume you, where they can contact you, and anything else you'd like to promote.
I appreciate that. No, I'm a senior investigative reporter at the New York Sun. So, I cover the FBI lately, the recent developments there. So,
got a lot on your plate, man.
Yeah, I filed yet another story before joining here. So yeah, but definitely check out the New York Sun. We're doing, I think we've got some new blood in there. It's doing great.
This ran on March 2nd. Well, it was last month. I got it.
It ran last month, and I joined them shortly thereafter. I had worked on this thing for I don't know how long, probably about half a year.
Again, this was just outstanding reporting. Great storytelling. Dennis, we really, all of us that are fascinated by this and love to research it and learn about the history of it. You know, if it wasn't for guys like yourself, we'd have no actual documents and court records we owe a debt to you for allowing us, doing the work that provided the stories for us to tell. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
For Benny. Behind the Glass, I'm Scott Bernstein, Original Gangsters Podcast. Please like, share, and subscribe. We'll see you next week. Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Nice. Talk soon, guys.